I'll be damned. We made it. We've made it to Mount Carson.
Carson?
Yeah, it's Century City. Let's go.
The truck they had taken had held up for 5 days, at last sputtering out of fuel. Another 4 days of fast walking through the northern Rockies had brought them home. The two men, who had been through a lifetime's worth of death and pain in the last 2 months, headed toward one of the many camouflaged entrances.
Okay, this looks like an entrance. Where's the rock?
Rock.
Thanks. Nope.
Halt! Who goes there?
It's Ted Roxon. I'm afraid that I don't know what the password is for this week.
My God! It's really you! We thought you were dead!
Not yet.
News spread quickly around the city, by phone and grapevine. Everywhere, the workers of the city, in the Liberator factories, the hydroponics facilities, even Dr. Schechter's science labs, came rushing from their jobs to see the returning hero. By the time Rock and Archer reached the main thoroughfare of the underground city, crowds were already beginning to gather. Security was having a tough time holding back the throng. Reporters from the city's two newspapers, the Century City Gazette and the Free Fighter News, stampeded through the security ring, snapping at the two heroes with cameras. Before Rock could speak, the crowd surged through and lifted the two Free Fighters on their shoulders, carrying them in a triumphant procession around the underground square.
Hey, Detroit!
Well, look who's here! You tired of all those Russian girls?
The food, pal! The food!
As the crowd let him down, the Doomsday Warrior saw Chen, the Chinese martial arts expert of Century City and one of his closest friends. The master of six fighting arts bowed and then looked up at Roxon with a relieved expression. Rock returned the bow. Then Chen walked quickly away, not wishing to partake in such emotional displays. Roxon understood. They would talk later. McCoughlin pushed his way through the crowd, his wide girth knocking people aside. He came up to Rock and looked up with a big smile.
Thought you was bear meat!
A few tried, but they spit me out. Come on, folks. Time to get back to work. I'm sure there's plenty to do around this place.
Whoa!
Hey, it's me, you mismatched-eyed mutant. Rona!
Rona! It's so good to...
She's been waiting for you to get back, Rock. I think she learned a trick or two.
After all this is over, you know where my room is. Here's a copy of my card. Just come and plan to spend the night.
And then she was gone. Rock and Archer gave up and let the river of humanity release their stored up feelings. There wasn't a hell of a lot of good news that hit these parts, Rock knew, so he might as well let them have their moment. Century City had been born out of death. September 11th, 1989. When out of the skies, thousands of needles of flaming death, multiple warhead nuke missiles rained down on America. The attack had taken everyone by surprise. Everyone knew times were tense, but both sides continued to talk peace, even while they prepared for war. Until at last the nightmare of the 20th century came true in a maelstrom of blood and fire that even the darkest imagination could never have conceived. On Interstate 70, winding out of Denver and into the mountains toward Utah, thousands of vehicles, cars, trucks, tractor trailers, were moving through the 5-mile tunnel bored through the very core of the surrounding mountains. The nukes that hit Colorado Springs, Longmont, and Fort Collins shook the Rockies. The tunnel entrances were lost in an avalanche of rocks and boulders, sealing off the stream of drivers in their Mack trucks and Chevys and VW buses. But saving those trapped inside the 8-lane tunnel from the effects of the blasts going on outside, as well as the immediate rain of fallout blotting out the sun for days. The survivors, men and women and children from all the broad cross-sections of American culture and races, got together and planned. They divided up the small amount of food and water that some of them had happened to be carrying, and tried to figure out just what the hell to do. Fortunately for them, two long diesels filled to the brim with supermarket goods had been trapped inside as well. They constructed makeshift charcoal filters and dug and drilled the eastern entrance for air. They quickly understood the enormity of what had happened, And even worse, the first man out spotted giant Soviet airlifters dropping paratroops over Denver. The Reds weren't content with blowing up half of America. Now they wanted to take it over as well. They sealed themselves off again and worked on survival. All the goals, careers, loves, and hates that had meant everything to them just days before were now but mere dust. They worked at building some kind of a base, a headquarters to live in, and from which they could strike out at the Russians. But soon leaders emerged. Men like Bonn, Ostrother, Taggart, who elected to do more. They would build an actual underground city, linking up some nearby mining tunnels and the tunnel of Interstate 70. They would construct lighting, ventilation, even hydroponic tanks so they could have their own food supply. For amongst the involuntary inhabitants of the new subterranean world were experts in almost every field. Doctors, chemists, mechanics, scientists in almost 15 different fields. After all, they were Americans. A people whose country had been born out of hardship, pain, and an eternal struggle for freedom. And they would one day be free again. Of that, there was no doubt. Even if it took 100 years, hence the name, Century City. A city born out of the ashes into a world of flames and unimaginable ferocity. Roxon couldn't help but think of those early years as he was rushed along at the head of the swell of people. They went past the brilliantly lit Liberator rifle factory, which shipped out nearly 100 rifles a day to other free-fighting cities, past the giant Central Library, past the Museum of America's Past, filled to overflowing with artifacts of Americana, past the entrance to Dr. Schechter's science labs, where miracles of technology were turned out on a monthly basis. Roxon took it all in as the crowd pushed him forward and realized for the first time just what a marvel this place was, and how glad he was to be in the only place he called home. At last, the crowd reached the largest open area of Century City, Lincoln Square, with its steel sculpture of the famous president 10 feet high sitting in its center. As the throngs pushed him toward the center podium, Rock saw Rath, the moody, dour security chief, coming from a doorway. Rath eyed the crowd nervously. He didn't like dramatic displays, and this group was getting out of hand. He went straight for Rock. The Doomsday Warrior gave up trying to hear what Rath was saying. He held out his hand.
Well, I really don't know what to say.
What did you see? What's out there?
Okay, well, I guess I can tell you a little about what Archer and I saw out there in the unexplored north. There's a lot of stuff going on up there. We went through South Dakota, Iowa, and God knows what all. We met a lot of people, a lot of good and evil. There were Amazon women warriors, giant swimming monsters, walking anachronisms, and car-driving bandits. But America is alive out there. And there wasn't a single Red anywhere. And as for our Moscow trip, I think we gave a blow to the Reds that they'll never recover from.
Sorry to cut your fun short, folks, but Roxon and Archer here are tired. And for security reasons, we can't allow any more information out about any military actions taken in Russia. You can hear the unclassified versions of the tapes we'll make when we debrief them in a few weeks. Now there's liberators to be assembled, tunnels to build, game to be gathered. We may sometimes feel like life is getting sweet, but it's not. Don't any of you fool yourselves for one second that things are all okay around here these days, because they're not.
Well, you're sure a cheery fellow.
Yeah. Things are bad, Rock. Very bad.
You're not usually so glum, Rath.
Come on, let's get you through decontamination. And then we'll talk.
The security chief, his long back hunched over as if he were deep in thought, headed back toward his office as Shannon led Rock and Archer to the decon chamber. They walked inside the glass booths that stood built into the solid rock walls, 20 of them, shaped somewhat like telephone booths, standing several feet apart. Rock began taking off his clothes on the wooden platform outside and glanced over at Shannon, who was staring at him hard.
I'm not into exhibitionism.
Sorry.
Rock undressed and stepped inside the booth. The decontamination unit worked in three stages. First, he was sprayed with hot water mixed with a special cleansing agent from nozzles above him, then rinsed free of the suds. The second stage set powerful vacuum pumps in motion on all sides of the chamber, sucking off any small particles of radioactive substance that might have adhered to his skin. The third and final stage was a series of purplish beams, bathing him with a relaxing heat that also destroyed any microbes or bacteria on the surface of his body. Roxen shadow boxed to make sure that every part of himself was exposed to the beam.
Decontamination procedure over.
Thanks.
Ultimate American.
Hello again, Shannon.
I took the liberty of getting you some fresh clothes. They're to your right.
Ah, thanks, Shannon. Shall we go?
Ah, Rock, Shannon, I've been waiting for you both. Please, take a seat. Now that I've got your full...
How are Kim and her father?
They're fine. Fine, it's a long story, but they're safe.
Well, where are they?
Well, after you created the diversion, the rest of the squad was able to get away. They accompanied President Langford and his daughter to Omicron City. Once news of his survival got around, a conference was hastily set up. There, they worked on developing a unified military council for all the free cities, and also a demonstration of some new anti-aircraft missiles, small enough to be fired by a single man. Dr. Schechter has been developing them, and plans to begin delivery of hundreds of them within the next several months.
I never heard of these missiles.
Yes, well, they were developed while you were away. He's been working on them for a long time and had a recent breakthrough in construction, based in part on some of the technology you brought back from the technicians.
So they're safe?
Yes, Rock, they're fine. Now, for the benefit of our records, please tell me everything, and I mean everything. Remember, we haven't seen you since the trip to Colorado to form the Reunited States, and that was months ago.
So Roxen told them everything, about the trip to Langford's cabin, about the earthquake and the megapedes, about losing Keppel and the Russian spy that ruined everything. He told them about Mountain Man Ed and how he died. He told them about the glowers and how they had brought the president and Kim back from the brink of death. He told them about being shuffled from Russian to Russian, eventually meeting and deliberating with Premier Vasily himself. Rath took copious notes, especially regarding how the Premier's servant had become his advisor. He told them about the small communities, from the Barbaras to the Jazzmen, from the Kriga to the anachronisms at the diner. And finally, he told him about the blow he had dealt the Russians, how the Premier had been publicly humiliated when the day of the games ended in riots and bedlam, how the jazz-playing dissidents had laid waste to one of their most oppressive jails, and how Roxen, aided by Archer, Keeper, Pete, and a handful of escaped prisoners, managed to bring down the Russians' ICBM control center. Without it, they would be unable to strike from afar. Their threats of utter and complete destruction would now have to be carried out by man and machine, not missile. At the end of Roxen's two-hour monologue, Rath turned off the tape machine.
Wow. Well, I think that's enough for now. Jesus, Rock. You really busted some red ass while you were over there.
Any free fighter would have done the same.
They would have tried, Rock, but you made it happen. But I'm afraid that we've heard all about the control center. I'm afraid it's one step forward and two back. Your actions in Moscow have apparently infuriated Premier Vasily to have a shit fit. The Reds are preparing a tremendous assault against us, the likes of which we've never seen in 100 years of the existence of CC.
Right, but they can't launch any big nukes against us from there. And if Schechter's air defense missiles are being installed here, what can they do?
It's grim, Rock. Our sources tell us that Vasily has assembled nearly 300,000 German troops. Nazi troops, I should say. This Nazi army has apparently been in the works for some time, under the firm grip of the Moscow Central Command. They were just waiting for the right time to use them, and it's here. They're fanatical, well-trained, and armed. Already nearly 200,000 of them have been airlifted to America and set up in a new fortress city the Reds have built called Zurch, just 80 miles south of here. They've already sent thousands of advanced commandos into the mountains, searching for Century City. And from our reports, the rest are soon to follow.
All this just for us?
Just us, Rock. They're not after any of the other free cities. They want to destroy Century City, make an example of it, grind it to dust. And they want you. They've already started northward through the Rockies, blasting everything in their path. And they outnumber our fighting forces at least 50-1. Even if we mobilized every man, woman, and child in the city, we haven't got near the firepower. They're moving in with artillery, armored assault vehicles, tanks, and a good 100 attack helicopters.
Shit. They're not messing around.
It could be too much for us. We can probably assemble perhaps 10,000 trained fighters armed with Liberator rifles, plus perhaps 100 mortars and an equal number of 55mm machine guns. We got plenty of grenades, small-scale stuff, and of course the four black beam pistols we have left.
Four? I thought there were five.
One just gave out. Schechter has no idea why. Could be power loss or inadvertent misuse of the weapon, but he's concerned that the rest might not last much longer.
What about the second expedition led by Erickson and Lang to bring back more particle weapons?
Haven't seen or heard from them for months now. They're way overdue. I hate to say it, but I'm afraid they may have bought it.
Erickson and Lang? Well, let me know if anything changes.
But enough of all this glum talk. We've got to do the best we can and hope. We have no choice. Whether we like it or not, they're coming. And coming fast.
All right. We'll build a number of defensive perimeters around Century City. And let's get Schechter to move up production on those new missiles of his. And none are to be shipped out. And can you assemble all the top military staff and Dr. Schechter to meet with me at 0800? Tell them to bring every goddamn idea they've come up with, no matter how bizarre.
Sure, Rock. We'll do.
Okay. I've got to get some sleep or I'll pass out at the meeting. Ring me up at 0700. Also, you'd better put the entire city on security status red. No outside excursions unless absolutely necessary. Have all internal radio and telecommunication systems shut down dead. Those Germans will have the most advanced technology at their disposal. Even though we're shielded in here, at close range, they just might pick up something.
Yes, sir. I'll get on everything right away.
Roxon looked the intel chief square in the eye.
And don't forget, Rath. The Third Reich was supposed to have lived 1,000 years, but it died in a hell of blood and fire. Maybe we can send these neo-Nazis down into the same grave where their Führer lies. I'm sure they'd be happy to join him.
Rock tossed in bed, searching for some sort of strategy that could hold the Nazi killers off. He realized with a sinking feeling in his gut that as the top military officer of the city, it was going to be up to him to come up with something. Come up with a miracle was more like it.
Where are you? I've been waiting all perfumed and ready for you.
Rona, I'm sorry, I
forgot about me? Is she that good?
Don't
insult me, Rock. Just come on over and we'll talk about it.
Shit. Didn't need this tonight.
So Rona was aware of Kim. How did she find out? Roxon had to admit, he knew it couldn't have gone on like this forever. He rose and walked over to the mirror that sat on one wall of the 10-by-10-foot room. Most of the free fighters had fairly draconian living spaces. Except for families with children, where the need for extra rooms was undeniable, the city's populace lived in simple rooms with but a bed, dresser, mirror, and a wash basin, and whatever decorations they deigned to put up. Space was at a premium here. Much of the additional chambers were carved out of sheer granite. They were at war, every minute, every day of their lives, and perhaps their plain, though comfortable living quarters made it that much easier to never forget it. Roxon splashed cool water over his face and stared at himself for the first time in ages. His violet and aquamarine eyes stared back as if looking at a stranger. His face had the look of weathered granite, tanned with thin lines around his eyes and mouth. He could see the life he had led over the last 20 years, years of violence and struggle, of desolation and awesome beauty. could see it all in that face looking back. Every encounter with the enemy, with the wild beasts of the plains and jungles, had left its mark on him, had grooved itself into his very flesh. He was like a walking sculpture, etched in blood, chiseled with knives and bullets. Plus, he hadn't shaved for days. A thick, stubbly beard had worked itself out over his lower face. He took a razor from his drawer and shaved the whiskers off until he looked at least vaguely presentable. Then he headed over to level 3 and Rona's room. Rona was an extraordinary woman, voluptuous, smart, and tough as nails. She was a direct descendant of the famous Flying Walenda's Trapeze Act, one of the most famous acrobatic and high-wire circus teams that had ever performed. And she had been brought up in their footsteps, touring the country when just a child with her father, who had his own mini-circus, until the Reds caught up with him and found out he had been performing intelligence services for the Hidden Cities. He had been taken away, and she had never seen him again. Somehow finding her way to Century City, where she had been welcomed, and stayed for the last 20 years. Here she had studied martial arts under Chen, and she was unquestionably one of the best hand-to-hand fighters in the city. Even Roxen had been thrown a few times by her quick moves. Unlike most of the women in Century City, she had demanded to be part of the combat squads that went out and raided Red convoys, and had joined Rock many times in attacking the enemy. She was as fearless as him, and as passionate. She was waiting for him, stretched out in her bed, decked with multicolored scarves and pillows, so that it somehow resembled a sultan's lovemaking chamber. Unlike many of the city's inhabitants, Rona reveled in beautiful objects, and around her room were lilies and vases, bright pictures on the walls, and an immense gold-gilded mirror that she had somehow finagled from the Century City Museum. Her long red hair flowed like a curtain of flame over her shoulder and onto her pillow behind her. She was wearing a nearly transparent negligee which accented her large perfect breasts, thin waist, and soft red triangle in a most complimentary way.
Let's see, you had to fight your way through grizzlies and saber-toothed mountain cats, and that's why you're late getting here, right?
How'd you know?
I hear things. Sometimes I don't like what I hear.
Rona, I...
Shh. Let me just remind you who's been waiting for you all this time.
Rona stood and slowly walked to Roxen. She placed a single finger over his mouth and took his hand in hers. She ran her hands over his chiseled body, going over all the right places. She slowly led him back to her bed, where she sat down and beckoned to him. Roxen walked towards her, unbuckling his pants on the way. Suddenly, he dropped on top of her.
Ooh!
A panther on top of its prey. Rona wrapped her strong arms around his muscled back. He pressed his face to hers and kissed her. Within seconds, they were passionately kissing, their hands searching over each other's flesh in wild desire. He bit softly into her neck. Her hands searched lower and found him, rubbing against it with desperate urgency. Rock trembled from the incredible sensation until at last his passion became too powerful. He flipped the negligee aside and spread her silky thighs. She lay back, her lips wide apart, eyes closed. Finally, she was ready for him, ready to embark on voyages both new and old.
What time is it? Oh, it's 0600.
He felt rested for the first time in weeks and knew he was ready to deal with the complex battle plans they would have to formulate. Rona was still sleeping, a wide smile on her creamy face. He rose and dressed silently, not wanting to disturb her, and made his way out of the room, leaving a note on the table.
Thanks for reminding me just how beautiful a woman can be. Those buffalo can get pretty ornery sometimes.
He tracked down Archer, who had become sick and tired of all the attention that was being bestowed upon him, finding him in a faraway corner of the city, in the steam pipe conduit tunnel that led from the geothermal source of Century City's power. Archer was lying atop a pile of flea-bitten hornbear rugs, half asleep, a bottle of Century City beer next to him. His eyes were red and puffy. His world was out there in the wilds, fighting things, surviving. Only then did he feel fully alive.
Had a hell of a time finding you. Hey, pal, no time for sleep. Your public and I need you.
No, Roxon. No speech.
Okay, how about some breakfast then? My treat. In the Skyview room. Everything you can eat. Steak, eggs, anything.
Okay. Anything?
After the sumptuous meal, Archer went off to set up the missile defense system at the top of Carson Mountain. His great strength would aid greatly in the placing of the launch tubes, as they were short of heavy equipment to move the high-tech weaponry around. Roxon headed down to the military operations room, where the general staff was waiting for him. They sat around a large, three-dimensional map of the Rockies, showing 300 miles in every direction. They greeted him warmly. Colonel Fenton and the generals Wooster and Janet Crawford, the only female general in America's long military history. Rock had put on his full military uniform, razor creased and bedecked with the medals that had been presented to him on numerous occasions. This was one of the few times he had worn the damn thing, usually feeling it representative of a military mentality and rigidity that he did not wish to display. Today, he wore it not out of pride, but as a confidence builder. He had to make the military council believe anything was possible. The entire council stood up straight as poles as the Doomsday Warrior approached the Oval Operations table, their hands snapping to salutes.
All right, let's get right to it. Intelligence reports first. Wrath?
Reports are coming in every hour, Rock. The Nazi troops have been dropped over a wide range of territory to our south. Apparently, as far as we can tell from our forward observation posts, nearly 50,000 commandos have already begun search and destroy missions through the Rockies. Apparently, the bulk of the force is to be landed by transport chopper at Forrester Valley. You know, that fairly flat plain, nearly 20 miles across. It's about 30 miles south.
I know where it is. I practically lived there as a teen.
Anyway, it would appear, although I don't want to say it's a surety, that the Germans will link up their forces there. The commando units coming down out of the southernmost mountains and joining with the main army. And Rock, these guys will be equipped with tanks, the works. I can only guess that they'll continue from there heading north, blasting the damned range to bits until they find us.
Who's the actual man in charge of the entire operation?
Rock opened the stiff collar of his uniform so he could breathe. Now he knew why he hated the thing.
Well, the chain of command, as far as we can make it out, is Vasily at the very top, though beyond setting the whole thing in motion, we believe he's back in Moscow now waiting. The commander of the U.S. operations is a pleasant fellow named von Reisling, from old German stock, eye patch and all. Beyond that, we don't know a thing.
General Wooster leaned forward, his jowled neck puffing up over the top of his collar.
How the hell did all these goddamn Nazis spring up out of nowhere?
I'm afraid I don't know. We've heard rumors of a neo-Nazi resurgence in Germany over the last few years, but Jesus Christ, I never knew they assembled an actual army. It must have been Vasily's ace in the hole, kept top secret until he needed them. But, from what we can gather, these guys are tough, well-trained, not babes in the woods, and they want to prove themselves. Let's not forget the military history of Germany, or the fanatical violence with which the Nazi troops of World War II fought. Every one of these guys is a killer.
Colonel Fenton, what's our exact military strength? And I don't mean bullshit strength. How many men and women are ready to fight?
I'd say 10,000 combat troops and another 10,000 we've been working real hard with, Rock. They haven't been under fire, but I'd swear my life on them. We've been increasing all advanced training tremendously in the last couple of months, Roxon, and we've come up with what we think is a new concept in attack strategy.
Yeah? Shoot.
Well, we've been feeling for a long time that our attack strategies are outmoded. We started looking for new ideas, and I went down to our military literature archive and dug up some books from before the war. And I found some, Rock. I found the training and tactical manuals for a special group called the Rapid Deployment Strike Force. Apparently, the American government, after a number of terrorist attacks on Americans around the world, decided to create a highly mobile, super-efficient unit capable of dealing out tremendous firepower and devastation. My entire staff studied them, and we came to a decision to implement these types of units.
Well, sounds great. What about our air power? I know we have that MS-20 we got from Westfort. Do we still have that?
We do, Rock. Not only that, but we've been stealing choppers whenever we can for the past few months. We've stolen nearly 12 attack choppers from the Reds, 5 of them jet-powered. Every one of those things is armed to the teeth with 55s hanging out of both doors, missile racks, napalm, phosphorus, anti-personnel bombs, even some air-to-air missiles capable of taking out a MiG. These things can do incredible damage, stun the Reds before they can stun us. We may wind up losing every goddamn one of them, but the pilots and crew are trained and raring to go, begging to go, I should say. They want to show that the free-fighting forces have teeth.
Excellent. What else do we have? What's our combat firepower?
We're in the best shape we've ever been in right now. 2 large munitions convoys were attacked within the last 6 months, carrying heavy stuff. We've got brand new, still-in-the-crate mortars, 55s, recoilless rifles, nearly 2 dozen streamlined field cannons, a ton of grenades and magnesium bombs. I needn't go on. We've got more than enough for the number of people we're going to be able to send out to battle.
Right. Well, we've got the tools. Now we've got to come up with a strategy that can save Century City.
General Crawford leaned forward, her blue eyes gleaming in her deeply wrinkled 60-year-old face. Crawford had begun her career in the Army unwittingly. At Century City University, she had majored in Russian studies, reading and absorbing everything she could on the nation that ruled a global empire. Her expertise over the years made her the leading mind on understanding the Red mentality. Gradually, her studies headed toward the military machinations of the Red Army, its weaponry and strategies. Before long, she had become the city's military staff's main consultant, spending her time helping them develop counter-strategies to the Russian brand of war. Somehow, over the years, she had become one of them, been given a rank and a uniform, and, without anyone really noticing, worked her way up to the rank of general. Her words were highly respected by everyone on the military council, and though just a frail-looking thing, more like somebody's grandmother than the razor-sharp analytic brain that she was, her words brought instant silence.
I've got a few thoughts on that.
Go ahead.
Well, we have to understand the military mind of the Reds in order to predict what they're going to do. There are basically 2 things to take into account here. 1, the Reds have operated under the same basic strategic guidelines since World War II when they fought the Nazis. That is large, dare I say, gigantic concentrations of troops and armor sweeping forward as a single unit. They believe in the power of strength, brute strength. There's little subtlety involved in how they operate. 2, they need to create an image. A dramatic demonstration, not just to us, but to the rest of the free fighters in America, that they can crush us as easily as an ant. Both these factors lead me to believe that Rath's conclusions about their beginning the main thrust from Forrester Valley with virtually everything they've got is true.
But the Nazis are running the show. This von Reisling, surely he'll prefer to use the German tactics developed by the Third Reich.
I doubt it, Rock. You've got to remember the paranoia of the current Russian command. In their own way, they're probably quite apprehensive about turning this Nazi army loose. How do they know it won't turn against them at some point? The Russians and the Germans have fought more wars between them than almost any other nation ever. They've got a history of confrontation and mistrust between them that goes back for centuries. I'll stake my reputation on the fact that the tactical maneuvers have been drawn up by the Russian High Command, and that the Germans will have little latitude in carrying them out. They'll be there, all right. All 250,000 men will no doubt begin in advance several miles wide, sweeping north until they find us. In my opinion, the time to strike would be there. We know where they'll be, and all their forces will be contained in a box 20 miles long by 5 miles wide. We must strike, and strike hard. We can't let them begin advancing through the mountains beyond that, or it'll be too late.
I agree. I think we must strike with everything we've got. We've got to flank them, break up the large force into smaller units that we can more readily attack. Our strategy should be to create confusion, break down their communications, and destroy their offensive advance before it even has a chance to get going.
They spent the next few hours hammering out just how their attack and defensive maneuvers would proceed, at last reaching a general consensus.
So we're in agreement. First off, construction and demolition crews will construct in the old gold mines 10 miles south of the valley, 5 fake century cities, complete with entrances and makeshift structures inside that create the appearance of a real city. They will be filled with high explosives. The Nazis might waste days battling their way into each of these and give us more time to deploy.
3 fallback positions, each the responsibility of different units of the city's army, will be set up in 5-mile intervals falling back from the valley.
The basic attack force will consist of 15,000 troops broken into 6 basic forces. First, artillery and heavy machine gun units will be set up at the northern edge of the valley. The second group will consist of combat units armed with liberators, smaller machine guns, and grenades. They'll take up camouflage positions on the lower portions of the slopes, holding back whatever troops actually reach the bottom of the mountains there. Thirdly, a cavalry of hybrids will pour into the Nazi forces from the right and left flank, and if possible, from their rear. Those men will also carry satchel charges to heave into the heaviest concentrations of equipment and troops. Fourth, the Rapid Deployment Strike Force. Fenton, those will be your men.
Thank you. The RDSF will use the choppers and will sweep the valley, wreaking havoc. Their main target will be the tanks leading the advance. The 5th group will be guerrilla attack units under the direct command of Roxanne himself. This squad will infiltrate their base undetected and try to take out as many officers as possible. If they can take out enough of the field command, the battle would collapse out of sheer confusion. The 6th group will be a special unit of men, proficient in the use of the remaining 4 black beam pistols. They will be spaced a mile apart with the artillery units. Their main target will be the air units, helicopters and jet fighters.
And if all else fails, Century City will be evacuated through tunnels that lead out the back, surfacing 3 miles north of the underground fortress. The city itself will be blown up with booby traps, creating a living hell for the Germans and their Red Masters.
Right. It all sounds good, on paper.
So, what about our communication systems? The Nazis will be able to hear our attack commands. That is, if they don't use jamming equipment to cut off our radio and walkie-talkie systems altogether.
I've been thinking about that, Fenton, and I think I've got a possible solution. I know it sounds a little crazy, but when I was with the Glowers, they taught me how to use certain telepathic abilities that apparently are latent in all mutants. I've experimented with it to some extent. I'd like to try and make contact with the other Star Pattern mutants in the city. There are about 20 of us by now. I suggest we use our electronic communications network in code. But if the Nazis shut it down, we should have a fallback system of mutant telepaths interspersed among all our forces so we can remain in contact.
Roxanne, forgive me if I'm a little skeptical, but...
I want to see if it can be taught. If it's not feasible, I'll be the first to let you know. Now, one final question before we start. How long do we have?
I'd say up to a week, Rock. This is one of the largest deployments of men in history. You've already humiliated Premier Vasily. He can't take another of the same magnitude, or his very power base might crumble around him. No, I'm sure the Germans have been ordered to get everything exactly right. Every man, every tank working and ready to go before they risk striking. They've got as much to lose as we do. A week, 10 days at the most.
Well, if we can't get it together in that time, we might as well forget about it. Good luck, everybody, and God help us all.
The meeting broke up as the military council rushed off to prepare their units for the battle strategy. Rock called all the Star Pattern mutants like himself, those with the slightly luminous 5-pointed star on their lower backs, together for the training session in ESP. Even he felt quite unsure of its feasibility, but anything was worth a try. He gathered them around him, Parcell, Watkins, Mooney, even Rona, in Chen's martial arts gymnasium. With its white walls, bare furnishings, and sound damping, it was the ideal place to see if the rest of the Century City mutants could do a damn thing with their abilities, or whether Rock could teach them. He explained the battle they were all about to face, and just how the telepathy could be used for communications. They sat around him on soft tatami mats, listening intently.
Now, I know you're all quite skeptical about this. Well, so am I. But I know the damn stuff works, because I've experienced it myself. It's subtle, very hard to use, but it does exist. The glowers communicate only through telepathy. And I tell you, when you hear all those minds joining, speaking at once, it's something you'll never forget. Scientists have known for centuries that animals, certain species, exhibit communication abilities that cannot be explained through science. Even ordinary Homo sapiens receive dim thoughts from those around them. But we filter it all out, as adults anyway. It would be too frightening to know what the hell is going on in everyone's mind, so the brain sabotages the potential for ESP by inhibiting these abilities. In us, the ESP capability is much greater. This accounts, I believe, for the so-called mutant's luck that I'm sure we've all experienced. That uncanny ability we have to survive where others don't, to somehow just know what's going to happen next. Now, I learned from the glowers how to increase and to amplify our special thought sending and receiving so that we can consciously use it to communicate. Theoretically, we can do it through almost any distance, through rock, steel walls. The telepathic wave, or whatever it is, doesn't seem to be stopped by solid material. I learned from them, out of desperation, Kim Langford, the president's daughter, was about to die. The glowers needed my special connection to her to enter her nervous system and put their own healing powers into use.
Rock noticed Rona looking up at him with clenched teeth as he mentioned Kim's name. But this was no time to hold anything back. With the survival of the very city at stake, Rock couldn't spare personal feelings, even Rona's.
Now, the telepathic ability seems to rise in power under situations of extreme desperation, fear, anger, whatever. Hormones are literally pumped into the body that must escalate certain electrical systems within us, so that without even realizing it, we send out calls for help, try to read our attacker's thoughts. So it seems that in order for you to learn, you have to become desperate, anxious, even terrified. And the situation we're about to face is, I'm sad to say, tailor-made for those sorts of emotions. Because the key to this battle is communications. Safe, undetectable communications instantly between all our scattered forces. If the Nazis can hear us, they'll know our moves and our positions. Okay, let's give it a try. I'll work with you one at a time to try and get you to feel what I'm talking about. Any questions?
No one uttered a word. They lined up and Rock pressed his widespread fingers against each forehead. He forced his thoughts of destruction, hellfire, rape, and torture into each brain, sending out the most powerful, terrifying images he could muster. And they felt them, drawing back in horror as the visions entered their minds. They felt both elated and disturbed at the process, wanting to help, but feeling that perhaps they were opening up a box that would never close. But there was no choice. He worked for a few minutes with each one, making sure that they all felt even the smallest jolt.
Okay, now you've at least felt the stuff. Now I want you to break up into groups of two and try it yourself. Don't worry about sending complex thoughts right now, just fear, anger, the base emotions. We can work on the more subtle possibilities later. Meanwhile, I'll work individually with each of you to help you focus. Rona, how about you first?
Sure, Rock.
Okay, close your eyes. I'm gonna send you images, and I want you to try and tell me what you see, okay?
Go ahead, Rock. I'm seeing flashes. Of death. Bodies in fields. The Mindbreaker? Rock, was that Westfort?
Very good, Rona. Now open your mind. Try and communicate without speaking.
Okay. I'm seeing rows of bodies on crucifixes. Oh!
children torn from their mothers, crushing loneliness, fire, pain, sorrow. I can't. Please.
You've done it, Donna. You feel it. Rise above the pain. Concentrate on the ability. Now tell me something, with your mind, not your lips.
What should I say?
You've already said it.
Their minds suddenly connected, like two pieces of a puzzle. They were joined to one another in a way that they had never experienced before, even in their most intimate moments of lovemaking. She could read his mind. His life was before her, unfolding like a film. Images like a whirling, spinning kaleidoscope flashed through her brain.
The pain that you live with each day.
For the first time, she suddenly felt she knew him, understood him. And he felt her great courage, her love, her infinite desire for freedom and truth. And he was glad that they would probably die together on the battlefield. For if Kim were his love, then Rona was his faithful heart. They stopped at last and hugged, exchanging a tender kiss. Then he went on to the next mutant to try to bring out his ESP abilities. There was no time for the emotions he wished to share with her. And there might never be. Rona sat on the white tatami mat, overcome. The pain her lover had been through, his family being killed, his lonely, starving trek as a mere child across America. All the people he had known cut down again and again. She saw all the horrors he had been privy to. She never knew why he was so hard before. Now she understood. Dawn broke like a shell burst on the morning of November 13th, splattering the purple skies with fragments of red and green, slicing through the high cloud cover with tongues of orange sunlight. Ted Roxon sat high on one of the northern peaks overlooking Forrester Valley, a pair of binoculars in his hands. He raised them to his eyes and stared out over the vast valley floor below. The Nazi troops were pouring in from every direction, filling the flat plain set between two ranges of the Rockies. They came from the mountain opposite Rock, far across the valley, from the woods on each side, joining into bigger and bigger concentrations. Huge helicopter transporters filled the skies above, setting down and dropping off M2 Panzer tanks, armored vehicles, and field artillery. The flat valley floor was a beehive of activity, as jeeps and the immense 60-foot tanks screeched around, trying to position themselves. But the picture was becoming clear, even in the midst of confusion, as the panzers pulled up the front ranks and combat troops began falling in behind them, bayonets fixed to their Kalashnikov 5 auto rifles. Rock pushed two buttons on the side of the computerized field glasses, and his range of vision suddenly shot into super magnification. He could see the faces of the troops and their officers, sweating, tense as they set up into formation. He could see the churning treads of the super panzers as they sent up waves of yellow dust from the loose packed dirt of the valley floor. He turned the glasses slightly as he caught the motion of a Soyuz transport chopper landing. It was the largest copter he'd ever seen, nearly 200 feet long and 50 feet high. Out of its bay doors came the strangest tank Roxon had ever seen.
What the hell?
In the place of treads, the tank had immense, stilt-like, jointed steel legs. He watched, open-mouthed, as it literally walked over boulders and up steep slopes to get a better position, high up on a mound. It bristled with cannons and machine guns.
Rock-walking tanks? Shit. We've never even heard of those things.
He shifted the glasses up to the far mountain, 20 miles off. He switched on the adaptive optics to correct for any disturbances in the irradiated atmosphere.
and activated the stabilizing mechanisms to prevent the image from shaking too much. The command tents of the German officers sprang into view as if he were right on top of them. Angular-faced, blonde officers rushed in and out of what was clearly the main headquarters, with a Nazi flag and a red hammer and sickle snapping in the wind on each side of the entrance. Von Reisling would be in there overseeing the battle, along with all his top staff. And Rock knew that that's where his team was heading right now. Detroit, Archer, Chen, McCoughlin, and Rona, who had demanded to be taken. They were after big game, the entire command of the Nazi forces. He wished he could have been with them himself, not up here on this mountain peak. But the military council had strongly requested that he coordinate the entire scope of operations. The five of them had started out before the sun rose, heading far around the valley to come up behind the German lines. He sent out a silent prayer for their safe return, though God only knew how many of them would be left alive at the end of the day, how many faces he would never see again. He steeled his jaw and banished the emotions deep inside his chest. The Doomsday Warrior stepped down from the observation post and looked back and forth along the 10,000-foot mountain peak that he and the main artillery units of Century City stood on. They had nearly 50 cannons. Some were brand new, capable of firing 122-millimeter shells at the rate of 20 a minute. Others were old 85-millimeters, stolen from the Reds. There were even a few 152-millimeter monsters, which fired 6-inch shells, capable of taking out even one of the superpanzers with a single hit. The artillery was hidden under netting and spread out along a 2-mile width, with 200 mortar men and heavy machine guns interspersed between them. It was his decision, and his alone, on when to begin the attack. Rock knew they were all waiting, the machine gunners and small mortars on the lower slopes, the teams of hybrid squads carrying their sapper charges hidden in the woods on each side of the valley, the ski units carrying light auto-fire poodle punchers and wearing cut-off narrow skis capable of maneuvering at lightning speed on the snow-covered slopes, the rapid deployment helicopter force, all waiting for the red flare he would fire high over the valley to signal the commencement of fire.
Just a few more minutes until they've landed more equipment, but aren't organized yet. We'll strike them when they'll be most off balance. Just a few more...
Hey, Rock.
Who's there?
Whoa, sorry, sorry.
Dr. Schechter, what are you doing up here? We need your brains back in CC.
Rock, if we don't win today, there won't be a CC. Besides, I couldn't stay back there while everyone I know and love is out here ready to give their very lives. Anyway, I've got a Liberator here and a flak jacket, so I don't have anything to worry about.
Well, then pick a good seat, because the action's about to start. How'd it go with those phony Century Cities on the mountains south of here?
From our transmitters inside the three we managed to build, we heard the explosions. I can't tell you exactly how many men they lost, but a lot. We've got some people finishing up construction on two more just south of CC itself, in case we have to fall back. But they're just diversions, Rock. You and I both know that. It's what happens down there that counts.
Okay, well, I'm glad to have you aboard. Somehow, I never thought we'd be fighting together. But just do me one favor. Keep your damn head down. I don't want to have to worry about you when I should be overseeing our battle progress and communications. Sorry to be so blunt,
No apologies, Rock, I understand. I'll stay low, and only fire when I see the whites of their eyes.
Well, get down, Doc, because it's about to begin.
Schechter found a cover behind several large boulders at the edge of the peak as Roxon looked around a final time. The artillery squads were looking his way, their hands itching to fire. Everybody was waiting for war.
There's no time like the present.
The Nazi army below froze as a deathly silence settled over the entire army for a split second. Then the artillery opened fire.
Alpha 1 to Alpha 2, do you read?
I read Alpha 1. Fire the leftmost transport chopper. We'll flank.
Roger that. Fox 2 firing. Direct hit. We are
Within the first 30 seconds, the RBSF had knocked nearly 20 of the huge choppers from the sky, sending them plummeting into their own forces below in screaming balls of flaming, twisted wreckage. 30 swastika-decorated attack copters were mixed in among the transports, but at such close range, they found it hard to fire without hitting their own aircraft. The element of surprise was working. The attack force was ripping through the nearly 80-copter force like wolves in a chicken coop. The artillery continued to pound away, by prearranged command, at the forward tank force and the very rear of the army, trapping them in a barrage of exploding steel. Now it was up to the sappers to create havoc in the mid-ranks, to try and panic them into retreat. Rock edged forward onto the outcropping, zeroing his field glasses in on the eastern flank, just at the edge of the thick woods. The hybrid cavalry should be coming out just about now. Sergeant Abrams leaned forward in his saddle, patting the thick back of his hybrid steed. The Brits had had their ears stuffed with cotton, but even so, they knew something was going on, and they didn't like it one bit. All along the perimeter of the forest, he could see the other teams preparing to charge straight into the center of the German ranks. Abrams grabbed the reins of his Brit, holding his pump 12-gauge shotgun in his right arm. He couldn't help but think for a second about the irony of it all. He was a Jew. His people had almost been extinguished from the face of the earth 150 years before by these same Nazis, these same diseased minds. He was thankful he had the opportunity to destroy them.
Here is where the Nazi plague dies.
Let's go, men!
The sapper teams came out of the woods, 1 minute apart.
Yes! Everybody ride!
For every free fighter shot down, the Germans lost 20 men and tons of equipment. Abrams was on his own now as the cavalry rode on. A huge smile covered his red-bearded face as he blasted away at full speed, sword in hand. Abrams was knocked unconscious for a few seconds and came to find himself pinned under the bridge. It was dead, a piece of shrapnel in its neck.
Damn. My leg broken. So this is it. So be it. On this day, Jacob Abrams found his peace.
He had reached down to his cartridge belt to reload when he saw a shadow just below him on the slippery ground. He looked up into the face of a leering German, bayonet ready.
Die, American scum!
You first, Nazi pig!
Abrams felt his mind growing dim as the blood pumped through the wide slit in his abdomen. His eyes closed as the voices of his ancestors cried ghostly tears in the deafening air around him. On the northern ridge, Roxen could see the battle being played out, the shells falling among the advancing panzer divisions, hundreds of them, which had managed to regroup amidst the flaming carnage. They swept toward the bottom of the mountain on which he stood, raising their 152mm cannons and beginning to rain their own murderous hail of shells back up toward the free fighters. On the valley floor below, the hybrid attack teams were creating trails of carnage, leaving bodies and wreckage behind their galloping hoofs. But they were only human and bled and hurt and died. Round after round poured down on them from the German troops who were slowly reorganizing themselves. One, then another of the brave free fighters fell beneath the fuselage.
the skies were filled with their own roaring air battle. The Rapid Strike Force had taken out half of the 80 Red transport choppers, and the rest had finally fled at top speed, hightailing it back over the southern ridges to safety. Now it was a battle between the Nazi attack copters and Sisi's own fleet. The free fighter pilots were amazingly proficient, considering how little training they'd had. They swirled and dove, always two at a time, one blasting its way, with the other riding shotgun 20 yards behind. The attack formations had been taken right out of the century-old manual from America's first attack fleet, and the free-fighting pilots followed it to the letter. And it was proving highly successful. The Nazi pilots had been well-trained, but only in the unimaginative strategies of the Russian manuals. The Reds were used to strafing rebels, shooting at ground targets. They had never faced a foe like this. 75 of the jet-powered Stulag 5s blanketed the sky, but they were so immense they took precious seconds to turn and evade. And with so many of their own in the sky, they were unable to fire their heat-seeking missiles for fear of taking out a Nazi craft. Hysterically, they tried to figure out some way of dealing with these pests, these gnats, who were shooting them down like clay pigeons. Rock swept his computer-enhanced field glasses over the battle scene, barely able to keep up with the action that was unfolding throughout the flat valley. The tempo was speeding up as the Germans at last seemed to get a grip on themselves, their officers taking control, shooting fleeing troops if they had to. Slowly, ever so slowly, they managed to get themselves into their battle formations, the big lines of panzer tanks taking the lead, grinding toward the northern mountains, two rows of 100 tanks each, every 200 feet. The Doomsday Warrior could see their hastily implemented defense strategy unfold as columns of tanks that had been the last to arrive by transport chopper moved from the center of the plain out to the sides. Straight lines of steel death, their cannons pumping out shell after shell toward the woods and the concentrations of American hybrid squads. They were going to try to create a box, a square of tanks around the entire valley, protect themselves on every flank, and at the same time, box in the free fighters down there, fighting for their lives.
Damn! I didn't think they'd respond so quickly.
We're getting reports around the field, but they're spotty. The Germans are responding too quickly to our communications. We think they've cracked our code.
Roxen felt a strange emotion surge through his soul. Something he had never felt before. It was fear. Not for himself, but for all those men and women down there on the plain below who had trusted him and the general staff. They were going to die. They fought bravely and with all their hearts. But it was just too much.
I have to try. Everybody, you are being cut off from all sides. Form a single force and head east before tanks form a complete trap. East, hook up and head east.
I hear you. Sure thing, Rock. Message received.
Blackbeam squads, fire a tank column moving from center of valley to east. Try to cut off our forces. Stop them. Concentrate all firepower on column heading east. After you shoot a few times, get a different position. They can trace the beam when it's fired.
Roxen turned his eyes skyward as the maelstrom screamed out from the valley behind him. He searched through the clouds, trying to penetrate the very cosmos, searching for a saving sign.